The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print-impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Today, I will read a new short story by 86-year-old Joyce Carol Oates, who has published 58 novels, a number of plays and novellas, and many volumes of short stories, poetry, and nonfiction. She has won many awards, including the National Book Award for her novel Them in 1969, two O. Henry Awards, the National Humanities Medal, and the Jerusalem Prize in 2019. From the fiction section of the March 24, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine, The Frenzy by Joyce Carol Oates. Early afternoon, driving south on the Garden State Parkway with the girl beside him, passing exits for Point Pleasant, New Jersey, for Toms River, something haphazard in his driving today, which is unlike him. Wind from the Atlantic is rocking the Subaru Forester, and he feels a thrill of, what is it, a tug? Like a tug of war, invisible hands on the wheel, which is his wheel. So his reaction is to resist the intrusion, the way he resists the subterranean pull of sleep when he wakes before dawn, stunned and exhausted by dreams. Cassidy is feeling reckless, young. Is something wrong? The girl asked sharply. How like this girl to register the nuance of a moment, a half moment when he almost lost control of the car. Affably, he tells her, no, not a thing is wrong. It's just wind. Resenting the question, not that he will indicate resentment. His manner with the girl is more bemused, placating. Next exit, Barnegat Light. Cassidy feels a pang of nostalgia. No children in this vehicle, no plans to exit. Climb the winding steps to the top of the old lighthouse, peer at the ocean through mounted binoculars, while gulls and terns circle the balcony, as if expecting to be fed. Does Cassidy miss being a daddy? A daddy to small children? The overseer of so much emotion, a puppet master with weary arms? Cassidy half expects the girl to suggest that they go to the lighthouse. It's the sort of tourist attraction that might appeal to her, an occasion for girlish enthusiasm, photos to take on her iPhone. When they leave the Garden State Parkway for Ocean Drive, she asks if they could please not talk for just a while. The view is so special, she doesn't want to be distracted. The coastal view is special. The wintry Atlantic, roiling, frothing, glittering like a gigantic skin shaking itself, great galleon clouds passing overhead, torn and tattered by the wind. But he still feels rebuffed, rebuked. Please don't spoil things by talking. He wants to protest. She was the one who set things back in motion, calling him the night before. A clandestine call at 12:20 a.m., when she knew that he'd be awake and his wife would be asleep. This is something he has shared with the girl, an example of how admirably she differs from the wife. When she called, he was, in fact, lying in bed, beside his sleeping, oblivious wife. Lying in bed and thinking of her, the girl, the teenaged mistress. What would he do with this girl? Or to this girl, if they were alone together in some neutral space, an impersonal and unnamed space, a very private place, a high-ceilinged luxury hotel room without windows or even a door, a floating kind of place, an offshore kind of place, soundproof. He made his way barefoot through the familiar dark of the bedroom to an adjacent room where his cell phone was charging. Like a heart detached from its body. Hand shaking? No, his hand was not shaking. In the bedroom, his wife slept unknowing. In their rooms, his teenage children slept unknowing. On the phone, that giddy sensation of giving in, sinking, as if boneless, willless, to which he had become addicted. And now, the next day, the next afternoon, he is driving south on Ocean Drive along the Jersey coast with the girl beside him. Through swaths of bright, blinding sunshine, punctuated by the flitting shadows of clouds. It seems a kind of miracle, one he'd never have predicted, for each time they've said goodbye, it has seemed to him the final time, the sensible final time. Yet here he is, and Brianna is beside him, in this fraught period before Christmas, after which he has decided his life will shatter and reorganize itself. In his elated state, he drives at just above the speed limit. No hurry about the drive. They will arrive at Cape May well before dusk. With the girl beside him, he has all that he requires. So long as they are alone together, and she is in his custody, so to speak. Brianna has been sitting forward in the passenger seat, taking pictures with her phone, marveling at the view, the wind-buffeted ocean waves, the light shivering and rippling to the horizon where it dissolves in mist. Brianna's concentration appears to be genuine, unforced. He envies her this childlike enthusiasm, so different from her frequently sulky, peevish moods. A teen-aged mistress. What else could he expect? In fact, Brianna is nearly 20 years old. Her birthday is next month, January. A Capricorn, she told Cassidy. Does a year make a difference? If when his wife discovers the liaison, if when he decides to reveal it to her, will an affair with a 20-year-old seem slightly less reprehensible than an affair with a teenager? A teenager who is, in fact, known to his wife. The daughter of friends in Fair Hills, New Jersey. Waves glittering to the horizon, pewter-colored, hypnotic. Cassidy is reminded of how he once purchased a ticket on a chartered boat out of Provincetown, taking passengers on a 5-hour excursion out into the Atlantic. Open ocean, immense sky, rocking boat, no sight of land. A mild sensation of panic. After 2 hours, the guide summoned passengers to the railing. The Provincetown Princess was cutting through a plankton path, a wide swath of ocean where fish were feeding. Thousands of fish, even millions of fish, writhing silvery bodies in the dark water. Savagely frenzied activity of a kind that Cassidy had never seen before. It left him appalled and shaken. It was explained to the passengers that a concentration of plankton had drawn swarms of small fish to the area. The concentration of small fish had attracted larger fish, which devoured the smaller fish. These predators attracted larger predators to devour them. The popular term for this was feeding frenzy. Cassidy stared, transfixed by the horror of it, repelled, yet unable to look away, feeling the first twinges of nausea. Spread out before him was a region of unfathomable appetite, foaming, churning, flashing, quicksilver with the eel-like bodies of fishes, a sheer boundless thrashing energy. The guide prattled on, reciting prepared words. Are there sharks? Children kept asking. An abrupt loathing of the ocean itself swept over Cassidy. The very sight, smell. What beauty there was in it was a matter of distance. Fairy lights twinkling on heavy, heaving water, not seeing the feeding frenzy beneath the surface. The ceaselessly rolling, jolting boat was sickening to him, too. That the movement was unstoppable, and that of his own volition he'd condemned himself to 5 hours of this misery, further disgusted him. He was alone on the chartered boat, not yet with Charlotte, whom he would marry 2 years later. No woman at his side to lay a hand on his arm, to comfort and distract. Cassidy has an impulse to tell the girl beside him about the horror of the feeding frenzy. He likes to tell her about incidents from his past, accounts that he has embellished over a period of years, but that are new to her, and, if new to her, new to Cassidy as well. But she had pleaded with him, "Please, let's not talk for a while, okay?" Also, the feeding frenzy had happened long ago, before Brianna was even born. It could be embarrassing to bring it up. When Cassidy looks over at her, she is, to his surprise, no longer absorbed by the view, but peering at the phone in her hand. She has turned away, as a child might, hiding the little screen from adult scrutiny. Scrolling through emails, or Instagram, TikTok. "Have you been taking some beautiful pictures?" he can't resist innocently inquiring. "Yeah, yes I have." Smiling at Cassidy sidelong, a quick flash of her very dark eyes. Almost shy. "Great, you can show me later." His own cell phone, he switched off that morning before Varick Street, wanting to be, for the next 48 hours or so, off the grid. Is it cruel to refer to Brianna Rensselaer as his teenage mistress when she is nearly 20 years old and mature for her age? And she is Cassidy's mistress, only intermittently and unreliably. Also, mistress is a comical word, outdated, quaint. 10 days before Christmas feels to him like an ultimatum. He's not sure why. Each time they've been together, 5, 6 times 7, has seemed to be some sort of test. Whatever is to be proved remains unproved. He isn't desperate yet. He doesn't intend to push the girl. He has leased a condo overlooking the East River, but she has been aware of this for a week at least. No need to dwell upon it. He knows from experience that that is exactly what you don't do with them. Dwell upon a subject. Push. His own daughters. Other men's daughters. He's not sure what they will end up doing today. Brianna doesn't like to make plans. Shrinks from premeditation. Planning to have sex, for instance, gross. Planning an outing together, slipping away on a weekday, spontaneous, brazen, cool. A child of upper middle class suburban privilege, accustomed to others taking charge, protecting her. Looking out for her as you'd look out for a blind person crossing a street. He has made a reservation at the most highly rated inn in Cape May, just in case. Passing signs for Ocean City, the toll bridge at Corson's Inlet, 7 Mile Beach, coastal marshes, shorebirds, warbler migration in spring and fall, monarch butterfly migration in the fall. It has been years since Cassidy has driven this far south in New Jersey. Years since he hiked along the shore at Cape May Point. Amazing to think that he picked Brianna up in the late morning at a loft on Varick, where, she says, she is staying with friends, having moved out of her parents' house in Fair Hills. When he pulled up at the curb, she ran out to him, uncombed, streaked blonde hair, jacket unzipped, tossed her neon pink backpack and eyesore into the rear and climbed into the Subaru, half falling beside him, startling in her beauty, in her trust. Trust of him. Turning her face to be kissed, confident that she would be kissed, and kissed hard until she laughed in mild protest. "Hey, I've been missing you." "I've missed you." He wasn't angry with her then, isn't angry with her now. That's the surprise of it, every time, how you forgive them. He liked the intimacy. The girl's breath smelled of sleep, just slightly stale. No time for mouthwash, toothpaste, in her haste to see him. Always a jolt when he sees the girl. For the fact is, he's crazy about her. He just has to accept it, his occasional distrust of her. her obfuscation, squid ink released in the water to blind, confound predators. Finally, Cape May. One of the first hotels they pass on Beach Avenue is the Cape May Heritage House, where Cassidy has reserved a room. He tells Brianna that he'd like to check in now. She can wait in the Subaru while he runs inside. It'll just be 5 minutes. But Brianna is impatient to get to the ocean, to the beach, as soon as possible. It's 3:20 p.m. The sun will start setting in an hour, and she wants to get out of the damn car and walk, run. Her skin is luminous, pale with indignation. Her dark eyes are all pupil. Pointless to argue with Brianna when she's in this mood. Cassidy doesn't dare touch her as he'd like to, grip her shoulders and shake that petulant look off her face. He says, in his most reasonable voice, that they'll have time in the morning to walk on the beach. Yes? All day tomorrow. All day tomorrow? Brianna regards Cassidy as a child might regard an adult suggesting something so ridiculous, so hurtfully stupid, that she cannot find words to oppose him, but is struck dumb. Brianna zips up her bulky quilted jacket, pulls a crimson angora cap down over her forehead. She tells Cassidy to just please let her out. If he doesn't want to walk right now, he can check into the inn by himself. She'll meet up with him later. Jesus, no. Cassidy is panicked. What the hell is Brianna thinking? All this way to effing Cape May in December, and she's suggesting getting out of the vehicle without him? She is a teenager, impulsive, not thinking of anyone except herself. Silent on most of the drive, as if she'd forgotten Cassidy's very existence, totally immersed in her damned phone. Cassidy suspects her of texting with unknown parties constantly, compulsively. Brianna surprises him now with her sudden animation, as if a switch has been pulled. Haphazardly, Cassidy has continued to drive through the near-deserted historic district of Cape May. Desperate to interest the teenage mistress in stately old Victorian-era architecture. Hotels, inns, charmingly quaint bed and breakfast. A former gambling casino, refashioned as an arcade. Intrigued, Brianna is taking pictures again through the window. Cassidy remarks, "It's off-season here, but also off-century." "Like a time warp," Brianna says. She loves these old-fashioned places. But not all the specialty shops and boutiques are open. Some hotels are obviously closed, not just for the season, but permanently. Against the moldering stucco wall of the grand old Atlantic Hotel, folded up cafe umbrellas stand like upright corpses. Folly to have come here, Cassidy thinks. Over the water, the sky is glazed now with an arctic pallor. Massive snow clouds like battalions have smothered the sunlight. The last thing Cassidy wants to do is hike along the edge of the ocean. He's dying for a drink in a cozy bar. Still, it's a relief at least to have stirred some emotion, some feeling in Brianna. Easily bored adolescents. Notoriously. "Come on," Brianna says, poking Cassidy, suddenly playful, forgiving. "Trapped in this car for hours, Jesus!" The sulky mouth is beautiful again, smiling, eyes glistening. She's all elbows, knees, uncoiling legs. Cassidy recalls his daughters, his son, when they were small children, their sudden, explosive energy, when they still adored their daddy, never doubted him. Before Cassidy can properly park the Subaru beside one of the sand-swept walkways, Brianna scrambles out, winding a long crimson scarf around her neck, tugging on matching mittens. In her knee-high Italian leather boots, she resembles a springy colt yearning to run wild. Cassidy is left behind to lock up the vehicle. "He will punish her," he thinks calmly. That will be his reward, once they are alone in the room he reserved at the Cape May Heritage House. But now he is laughing and waving at the long-legged girl, hurrying to catch up with her. In love, this is how we behave when we are in love. Hiking at the water's edge, the wind is colder than Cassidy anticipated, razor sharp, making his eyes water. Beside him, the girl is exclaiming in excitement about the beauty of the ocean, the unspoiled beach, the funny little birds, sandpipers, pecking in the hard-packed sand. She seizes Cassidy's gloved hand in her mittened one and tugs him along, swinging their arms, forcing an antic mood in a way that Charlotte would never have done, even in her youth. Heedless in love, crazy for love, look at us. Except for an elderly gentleman walking his dog some distance away, both taking mincing steps, the beach and the boardwalk are deserted. No one to observe the lovers. No one to envy the middle-aged man with the much younger girl taking a romantic, if windy, walk along the beach at Cape May in December. Folly, Cassidy thinks, slightly out of breath, gripping her hand hard. Fate. He would like to ask Brianna why she didn't answer his calls for 5 days. Why she shrinks from acknowledging that, since he has rented a condo in Manhattan, there is no reason for her to continue to stay with friends in a drafty loft. But Cassidy knows that at the first sound of reproach, at the first demand, Brianna will flee. Can't risk it. In their most intimate moments, Cassidy has felt the tension in the girl's slender body, nerves strung tight as wires. Brianna seems to swing between two moods, intense enthusiasm, intense repugnance. It's Cassidy's fancy that she thinks with her entire body, strained, finely trembling. Her skin is always slightly feverish, unlike his own, which feels lukewarm to him, only half alive. Or maybe it's the effect of pills, the little white pills that Brianna carries loose in her pockets. Amphetamines, opioids, antidepressants, traded and bartered among her friends as casually as children in another era shared sticks of spearmint gum. Brianna has dropped his hand, pulling away, venturing so close to the splattering surf that her tight-fitting jeans are dappled with wet. Despite his discomfort, Cassidy likes it that Brianna Rensler has led him to a place, a specific place, to which he'd never have gone except in response to a whim of hers. He likes it that he is doing something out of character, something that would astonish his wife, his children, his friends, his business associates, if they knew. Also, Cassidy likes it that Brianna is nearly as tall as he, in the Italian boots he purchased for her. Though, when they are both sitting or lying down together, and the girl is naked, soft-skinned as a mollusk out of its shell, Cassidy looms over her. Trotting along the beach at Cape May in December, 46 years old, in an L.L. Bean fleece-lined suede jacket, corduroy trousers. His male vanity is such that he is hatless, freezing yet uncomplaining, short of breath yet invigorated. His pulse rings with an animal excitement indistinguishable from dread, panic, a flood of adrenaline as if his life were at risk. Brianna would be furious to know that Cassidy thinks of her, even half seriously, as his teenage mistress. Sexist a-hole thing to say, stupid. She'd slap his face, tell him to F off, go to hell. As it is, Brianna sometimes jokes uneasily about the age difference between them. Yet she was the one who pursued him. That has to be acknowledged. Cassidy catches up with her, slides an arm around her shoulders to rein her in, his prancing little horsey, kisses her mouth, but the gesture is awkward, clumsy. Their teeth strike together and Brianna winces. Her lips are luxuriantly cold, a pleasurable shock against Cassidy's skin. "Hey, I love you," he says, as she turns away. But the surf is too noisy. Brianna seems not to hear. Last time they were together, Brianna asked him not to talk like that. But he isn't discouraged. He will wear the impetuous girl down, he is sure. At this moment, the cloud bank shifts and the waning sun glares, broken on the waves, eerily beautiful, blinding. When had he fallen in love with his friend's daughter? 4 years before, at a school Christmas concert in Fair Hills, which Cassidy and his wife attended, with the Renslers, in fact, their daughters were both in the girls' chorus. Did she remember the Palestrina she sang? Cassidy has asked Brianna. The Vivaldi Psalm? Brianna frowned, trying to remember. So long ago, she was like 16? Maybe it hadn't been in love exactly, though certainly a sensation of falling. During the chorus's slow-paced candlelight procession down the center aisle of the auditorium and onto the stage, Cassidy found himself staring at a girl he didn't quite recognize as Brianna Renslers at first. Her heartbreaking face, utterly lovely. He couldn't look away, even when he belatedly realized who the girl was. A clutching sensation in his chest, a wave of vertigo, of a kind he hadn't felt in memory. The candlelight procession was one of the features of the annual winter concert. For weeks, his daughter Veronica and her friends had excitedly discussed it. Two by two, the choruses filed in from the rear of the auditorium to the stage. Girls in high-necked white silk blouses and long wine-colored velvet skirts. Boys in dark suits, ties. Slow, solemn Christmas music accompanied them, as if in church. Cassidy and Charlotte sat with the Renslers, who were long-time acquaintances, if not close friends. The couples made it a point to see one another several times a year. Cassidy craned his neck, waiting for Veronica to appear. His daughter was a plump-cheeked, earnest girl with close-set brown eyes, limp brown hair, a manner that was shyly appealing, like Charlotte's. Cassidy loved his daughter, 14 at the time, and feared for her for all that was to come, as almost pretty could be a harsh fate. There was something hypnotic in the way the candlelight procession continued. Girl after girl and boy after boy, only a few of the candlelit faces, such as that of Brianna Renslers, warranted a second glance. Attention beyond the obligatory pride of parents for their children. Cassidy had almost forgotten Veronica by the time she appeared. She passed nearly unnoticed as he stared at the Renslers' daughter, whom he could have sworn he'd never seen before. Brianna seemed scarcely to recall the winter concert. Girls' chorus wasn't an activity to which she devoted much serious time. Vaguely, she recalls the ceremonial procession, the fluttering candle flames, the white silk blouse, and the senior boy with whom she was paired. Of the blurred sea of rapt adult faces, her parents and Cassidy's and Charlotte's among them, Brianna remembers nothing at all. 3 years after the winter concert, Cassidy had more or less forgotten the Renslers' oldest daughter. Hadn't seen her in the interim. Never thought of her. She wasn't a friend of Veronica's. His wife had mentioned that their friends were having difficulties with their daughter. She'd dropped out of the expensive liberal arts school they'd sent her to. Possibly drugs were involved. She was living in New York City and estranged from her family. Then, in Penn Station, where Cassidy was about to board a train to New Jersey one evening, Brianna Renslers had approached him, boldly, flirtatiously. In retrospect, Cassidy would understand that Brianna was high, radiantly high, her skin luminous with heat and her glassy eyes glistening. She was with a tall, pasty-skinned boy with features as striking as hers. Might have been a male model. Photographs for Calvin Klein. In the congested area where passengers were waiting, they stood basking in the glamour of youth. "Hiya! Do you remember me? It's Brianna! Brianna Rensselaer! I was like 2 years ahead of your daughter in school. I've forgotten her name at Fair Hills High. You and your wife know my parents, I guess. Do you remember?" After the first shock had passed, yes, he did remember. Brianna had been in a giddy mood, pushing up against Cassidy, laughing, stumbling, holding out her iPhone to take a selfie of the two of them, disheveled and flush-faced. "Just for us," she'd assured him. "Just private." Sometimes Brianna confides in Cassidy a frequent complaint of hers. People won't leave her alone, are constantly trying to manipulate her. When Brianna speaks of manipulative people, she is referring to her parents, or her professors at Bard, or to mysterious figures who remain unnamed, unknown to Cassidy. These are people who are trying to blackmail her emotionally, put pressure on her, F with her head. Sometimes she slips, says, "you people," as if Cassidy were one of them. There's a therapist, or there was a therapist, who'd seriously F'd with her head. Friends she'd thought were trustworthy, who had betrayed her. It's titillating to Cassidy when Brianna speaks of her parents, as if, in complaining of them, Brianna is acknowledging that he, her lover, is not in the stifling category, parent, middle-aged, to which the Rensselaers belong. "It scares me how people disappear," she says. Turns out there are friends of Brianna's who have disappeared. A boy named Colin from her high school in Fair Hills. 6 weeks after he started classes at Stanford, he went hiking in the Santa Cruz Mountains and never returned. His parents flew out to Palo Alto, stayed for months. Police looked for him. There were posters everywhere, search teams. But he just disappeared. And a girl in Brianna's residence hall at Bard, she had taken the train into the city for some purpose unknown to her suite mates and never returned. One of Brianna's own relatives when she was a little girl, a male cousin of her mother's, was said to have disappeared in Tangier. How serious Brianna is, pressing into Cassidy's arms. So fascinated by her, Cassidy scarcely hears what she is saying. One night, in a small, hushed voice, she told him how there was this boy she knew. In fact, she'd been staying with him earlier in the semester, after she had dropped out of Bard and come to New York, where it turned out he was dealing drugs, mainly pot, but coke, too, when he could get a hold of it. He'd been at Bard, but transferred to NYU, and then dropped out of NYU, too, and was living over on Avenue A. He'd evidently made some enemies, and that was a serious mistake. Whoever they were, they broke into his place when no one was there and trashed it. And next time, this was after Brianna had moved out to Varick Street, they killed him. Stabbed him to death like 15 or 20 stab wounds. Torso, neck, groin. The body was in the apartment for 3 days. Only because someone in the building noticed the smell where police called. It was like an actual murder, like something on TV. In a tentative, wondering voice, Brianna spoke as if she doubted the authenticity or even the plausibility of what she herself was presenting to Cassidy as an adult with the power to interpret. What she couldn't forgive was what she had done, she said. Left her friend without telling him. Didn't leave a note, didn't text, no explanation. She had just fled. Shivering in Cassidy's arms, tears wetting her cheeks. Naked, so vulnerable. He kissed her and assured her that she'd had no choice, had had to save her own life. She'd done the right thing by leaving. Otherwise, she herself might have been killed, comforting her, rocking her to sleep like a young child. happiest hour of Cassidy's adult life. What Cassidy recalls of his Fair Hills life is its routine, the comfort of routine. How many years, decades, his wife, children, his friends, acquaintances, neighbors, who'd formed a circle of sorts, a net to secure him, define him, confine him. Endless rounds of dinner parties, cocktail parties, receptions, holiday season beginning after Thanksgiving and not ending until the last open house on New Year's Day. How boring it all now seemed. His wife's family, his family, relative, none of them chosen. The entire texture of that life, its willed imposture. Not that it died quickly, it did not. Like the carefully tended grass of a suburban lawn that gradually thins with time, is invaded by crabgrass, it experienced a slow, diminishing death. "Are you in love with someone else?" Charlotte had calmly asked Cassidy, her eyes grave and wounded, her voice steady. "We can talk about it if you are. If you think you are." He'd avoided answering her. Unprepared, hadn't the words just yet. Easier to suggest that she was imagining things. Soon afterward, Charlotte had a minor accident with her car. Pavement slick with freezing rain, she'd skidded into the rear of another vehicle. Terribly shaken, bursting into tears, but not injured. Thank God, Cassidy thought. If Charlotte had been injured, if she died, he could not have borne it. The burden of guilt. But the incident awakened in Cassidy the understanding that his marriage was vulnerable, expendable. A marriage can melt like wedding cake in the rain, of course. He has made the decision to move out of the house in Fair Hills, in which he's lived, happily enough, in fact, that's the baffling truth, for nearly 20 years. He hasn't yet told Charlotte. That will come in time. The ideal situation would be for Charlotte to pull the onus on him, ask him to move out. Still, he is grateful for his wife's restraint and dignity. Those very qualities in Charlotte that make her so reasonable, reliable, dully predictable, he values now as he makes plans to leave. She is so fair-minded. She can be relied upon not to rouse the children against him. For he could not bear being considered selfish, cruel, a bad daddy. He has simply lost his ability to impersonate himself. The way over time you can lose a skill like piano playing or speaking a language. The condo has been leased, though he is still officially living in Fair Hills. Just last night, sleeping beside the wife. Explaining or not explaining to her, carefully chosen words, spoken in Cassidy's normal voice, which is affable, consoling, circuitous, non-confrontational. He couldn't trust himself to speak otherwise. He didn't have the script. No way to confess to his wife of so many years that his secret sorrow has been gathering like phlegm in his throat. He wants only to spit it out. All this while, Brianna has been collecting things on the hard-packed sand of the beach at Cape May. What sorts of things? Anything that seems to catch her eye. Anything droll or strange. For instance, a piece of driftwood resembling a human arm. A child's sneaker washed clean and pale by the surf. A mollusk shell marked with hundreds of tiny stipples like spines. Brianna takes a picture of the shell on the beach, then holds it in her hand, staring as if at a talisman. Cassidy, who would like nothing better than to hike back to the Subaru, drive to the hotel, and have a drink, asks Brianna if she'd like him to carry these things for her. They should be heading back to town. It is nearing 4:30 p.m., and the sun is slanting toward the horizon in the west. The Atlantic wind has become increasingly cold, but Brianna seems scarcely to notice. She hands her worthless little treasures to Cassidy, then turns away to find more. There is something antic, willful in her behavior, but Cassidy supposes it's genuine. They have hiked a mile or more from the historic district of Cape May. The beach has become rougher, shabbier. The sand is eroded into curious little ditches, and there's litter underfoot, the mummified remains of dead fish. They are beyond the boardwalk, but a flight of wooden steps leads to the crest of a weedy hill about 12 feet in height. A wet, pungent odor of rot reminds Cassidy of the plankton field off Provincetown. That frenzied feeding in the churning water, the savagery and pointlessness of appetite. Brianna, shall we head back? But Brianna is trotting off in search of new treasure, taking pictures with her phone, continuously and compulsively recording whatever strikes her eye, whatever distraction, waves, surf, her own wet boots, twisted clots of seaweed, broken glass, Cassidy. He knows she has been taking pictures of him, mischievously, since he doesn't want her to. It has become a kind of joke between them, but not one that Cassidy finds funny. He is thinking ahead to their evening, to the night in a room in the Cape May Heritage House, furnished with period antiques. Utter privacy, secrecy. Brianna has a way of semi-collapsing on a bed, giddy drunk, giddy high, laughing at whatever her middle-aged lover does to her, of which she's sort of aware, unprotesting. Thinks it's funny, no big deal. Brianna's slender, twisty, eel-like body, the thrust of pelvic bones, shiny eyes rolling back in her head in passion, or a simulacrum of it. Once he grabbed her hard around her narrow hips, and she snorted in surprised laughter, kicking him as a child might kick, tugging at his hair, clawing his cheeks, playing rough, puppy rough, unexpectedly strong for a girl so underweight, saliva glistening on her chin like a tusk. She'd been incandescently high, her skin dry and burning to the touch, an artery pulsing in her throat, which he had to kiss. Hard. Cassidy tells Brianna not to climb those steps. The wood looks rotted. Brianna ignores him because she has glimpsed something in the weeds at the top of the hill. Monkey quick, she climbs the wobbly steps, snatches up what looks like a broken doll as Cassidy stares after her. Jesus, if she should fall, if she should injure herself, is he responsible? Would such an accident be reported? Find its way into a newspaper? Brianna waves the raggedy doll in the air. As she climbs back down, one of the steps collapses under her and she falls heavily, grunting to the ground. Cassidy, vexed with himself and with her, isn't strong enough to catch her in his arm. God damn! She can't have hurt herself, Cassidy thinks, stooping to help her up. She's whimpering. Tears glistening on her cheeks, dead weight at first, uncooperative. Has she twisted her ankle, sprained something? Why the hell didn't she listen to him? Cassidy demands, worried that if he stoops to lift her, he might throw out his goddamn back and suffer for days or weeks. Brianna is petulantly groping about for her cell phone, which is somewhere beneath the rotted steps, and she pushes Cassidy's hand away. Suddenly, furious with her, he snatches up the phone and tosses it into the ocean, cursing in a way that he has never done in front of her before. In that instant, she is stunned into silence, eyes wide, mouth dropping open. She cannot believe what Cassidy has done. Her iPhone, lost in the slovenly slapping waves, freezing, stinging waves, spray wetting their faces. Cassidy yanks the stricken girl to her feet, gives her a hard shake to stop her whimpering, tells her he will buy her another goddamn phone in the morning, but they are going back to town now to the hotel, for the night. Brianna paused at Cassidy, desperate to retrieve her phone. The effing phone is gone, he says. The water is too cold for her to wade into, too cold for him. F it! By now the phone is ruined, soaked. Just F it. Brianna is sobbing, limping as Cassidy walks her roughly back to the Subaru. His blood is up. He feels no remorse for what he has done as he promises he will buy a new iPhone for her in the morning. An updated model. The newest model. Not to worry. The information on her phone is saved somewhere in the cloud, whatever the cloud is. He's sure. Brianna continues to sob in shock, defeated. He has triumphed, as he'd hoped. Driving to the hotel on Beach Avenue, he demands to know why she didn't answer his calls. 20 or more calls over 5 days. What the hell was she thinking? Was she thinking? And then calling him late last night when his wife might have overheard? What was that about? In the passenger seat of the Subaru, Brianna is stiff with something like fear, guilt. Cassidy is fully in control now. The headstrong girl has become docile, unresisting. She has seen what Cassidy did with her phone. She has felt the strong impress of his hands on her. Her resistance has melted away like a tissue dropped in water. Just murmuring in response to his questions, "Don't know." And later in the hotel room, shrinking from his angry face, pleading, "Sorry, so sorry." In the morning, Cassidy heaves himself from the king-size bed. He is naked, prickly-skinned, smelling of his body. Bodies. Shaky on his feet. A mild thrill of disgust. He regards the still sleeping girl and the rumpled bedclothes on the far side of the absurdly vast bed. Her sickly pale face, not very attractive now, her hair matted. Her eyelids quiver as if she is trying to wake up but cannot. Her soft mouth is agape. On one of her bare shoulders, a thumb-sized bruise, which Cassidy sees was something like satisfaction, though also tenderness. Recalling how the girl stared at him the night before, in fear of him, once they were alone together. Fear that was a kind of awe, reverence. Knowing, accepting that she deserved whatever Cassidy would do to her. This submissiveness in the teenage mistress Cassidy has found addictive, like a narcotic. Brianna's eyes glassy in surrender, pupils dilated, his quick, hard hands, the authority in such hands. For all this, he will forgive her. He will reward her. He will purchase for her the very newest iPhone model. The cost is nothing to him. In the beautifully white, gleaming bathroom, a luxury bathroom, he's eager to shower off the body odor, for it is disgusting to him, in a way. She didn't resist, stumbling into the room the night before. This, the monarch suite. He helped her to the bed, where, feebly, she pushed his hands away, even as she continued to apologize. "Sorry, I'm so sorry, don't hurt me." Maybe she'd sprained the ankle or torn a tendon. She'd been desperate searching through the neon pink backpack for pills wrapped in Kleenex. Painkillers, she called them, which she needed badly, swallowed dry. Neither of them was in a mood for the historic dining room, where you were expected to dress formally. F it. He'd ended up practically feeding her the pricey room service dinner. She'd kept falling asleep. She hadn't resisted Cassidy. She never resisted Cassidy. Like a Raggedy Ann doll, obliging and, to a degree, even cooperating. If only she could keep her eyes open, which she could not. He'd tugged off the tight-fitting Italian leather boots, tugged off the tight-fitting jeans. As she tried to wriggle away like a large baby, He'd adored her, declaring that he would love her, would take care of her. When they returned to the city, he'd help her move her things out of the loft on Barrack, move in with him. "You know you love me. You know that." Later this morning, he will purchase a new iPhone for her. He's sure there's a mall somewhere near Cape May. Maybe then lunch, a visit to the lighthouse, the museum, back to the Cape May Heritage House he reserved for two nights. So simple. You make a decision, you act. Why hadn't he realized earlier in his life? Love is a decision you make. If only Brianna would remain the way she is now, has been since the accident on the beach, docile, meek, grateful for him. If only this permanently, the two of them, like this. Taking his time, in no hurry in the white tiled bathroom, Cassidy shampoos his thinning hair below the chrome showerhead, spreads soapy lather over his body, going to fat at the waist, his belly hairy, legs spread for balance. Taking care, he shaves his jaws with his safety razor. Now is not the time to rush, risk cutting himself. He rubs body lotion onto his hands, chest. Prides himself on the grizzled chest hair, genitals drooping between his legs, just visible over the swell of his belly. His beard is so heavy, he should shave twice a day. Testosterone. He regards himself sidelong in the large, steamy mirror, squinting, head cocked. Half-consciously, Cassidy has learned how best to observe himself. You do not want to look too directly. Leaving the bathroom, white terry cloth bath towel wrapped around his thick waist, he calls to the girl in the bed. "Good morning!" He is in an elevated mood, taking note that it's 8:41 a.m. by the digital clock on the bedside table nearest him, but there's no answer. He stands flat-footed, astonished to see that the vast bed appears to be empty, holding only the soiled sheets, like entangled white snakes. "Brianna, where?" On the floor, there's a pillow, one of the large ornamental pillows he kicked off the bed the night before. Brianna is gone. Unless she's in the closet. Not in the closet, he checks foolishly. And nothing on the wooden hangers, nothing on the shelves in the closet or on the floor. His clothes, his things, not in the closet and not on the chair where he tossed them, nor are the girl's clothes here. No quilted jacket, no Italian leather boots. The neon pink backpack is gone. Even the mirror against the far wall appears vacant as Cassidy stares, trying to comprehend. "Brianna, hey, Jesus, come on!" His breath is quick. He is feeling lightheaded, weak, telling himself, this is not happening. Of course Brianna is in the room somewhere, playing a prank. She must have slipped into the bathroom without his noticing. So Cassidy re-enters the bathroom, which smells of fragrant steam, inspects the shower stall with its soap-splattered glass doors. No one here, nothing. On the bathroom floor, sodden towels he kicked to the side for the housekeeper. Returning to the room, glancing quickly about, the things he left on the bedside table on his side of the bed, where are they? Wallet, cell phone, keys. Not on the floor, nothing on the floor except the pillow. Not even his socks, underwear, the girl's jeans he'd tugged off her, limp lower body, her underwear he'd let fall to the floor. No sign. Her cashmere sweater with the soiled neck, his L.L. Bean suede jacket, corduroy trousers, water-stained shoes. Where? On the table, the filth-stiffened raggedy doll Brianna found on the beach. This she'd left for Cassidy. He has only the white towel that is wrapped around his waist. He's shivering now, his teeth shattering, and a sudden hard throbbing in his head. Numbly, he checks the closet again, pulls out bureau drawers, nothing even to rattle in the drawers. No cell phone, no key to the Subaru. The girl has dared to take the Subaru key. She has taken his wallet, his phone, his clothes, his shoes. She has stolen his Subaru Forester and left him alone in the Cape May Heritage House, naked. Thoughts rush at Cassidy like missiles. It is not possible that Brianna Rensselaer has abandoned him in Cape May, New Jersey. It is not possible that Brianna can drive the Subaru back to the city. Has the girl that capacity, that sense of purpose? Will she ditch his vehicle on a deserted street on the west side and hike back to the Barrack Street loft? What will he do, stranded in New Jersey? What can he do? How did the girl deceive him? She was so deeply asleep, as if comatose, drugged. Oblivious of him, he'd thought, as he stood over her, gloating and protective, tender-hearted. She'd waited until he was in the shower, then slipped from the bed and thrown on her clothes, pushed his clothes, even his shoes, his wallet, keys, phone, into the neon pink backpack and zipped it up, thrusting her arms into the sleeves of the quilted jacket, breathless and charged with adrenaline, as if fleeing for her life, leaving the room and shutting the door behind her. Within how many minutes? Seconds? In the bathroom, he'd heard nothing. Cassidy checks the bathroom again, nothing. Drops to his knees to peer beneath the bed, but the bed is mounted on a solid wooden platform, no space below it. Exhausted now, his blood pressure mounting, Cassidy sits heavily, leaden on the edge of the bed, trying to think, stares at the digital clock for several seconds without registering the time, 8:48 a.m. At last, there comes a sharp, knuckled rapping at the door. In this instant, Cassidy is flooded with relief. Brianna has returned, of course. Brianna has returned. She has taken mercy on him. He is halfway on his feet to open the door, except the voice is unfamiliar. A woman's voice, expedient and charmless. Housekeeping. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that website is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.